Good morning and welcome to the February edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch, North Portland Library, and with me is
We'll be here on Reflections Bookstore.
Our third member, Emma Jackson, will be joining us later on in the program. Excuse me, I'm getting a look from our engineer that says that OB, you're not being heard very well. So while they're working it out, okay, we're going to proceed with what we're doing. It is our pleasure this morning to interview Dr. Manning Mirabel. He is, and I think I mispronounced that last name. I think I gave it a little more than a bell, Manning Mirabel. He is the author of Living Black History, How Reimagining the African-American Past Can Make America's Racial Future. Dr. Mirabel has just an incredible background. He is heading Columbia University's Institute for Research in African American Studies, has written 19 books. He has, in fact, in many ways, I think, lived black history because he's been able to meet and work with some of the best minds and the most outstanding African American leaders of the century. So, Dr. Mirabel, welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And thank you very much for your book. Reading this book was just such a pleasurable experience, which is not usually my take on nonfiction, but because I guess it was based on, in most part, a series of lectures that you did, it was just like sort of being there in the audience, hearing you, and just kind of retracing the steps with you. Why did you choose to write this book? You've written a number of books. What led you to this one?
Well, there were several events that occurred in 2003 that sparked the genesis of this of the book Living Black History. The first is the book I had just previously completed, also in 2005, is the autobiography of Medgar Evers, which was co-edited with Merle Evers Williams, the widow of the civil rights martyr Medgar Evers. In 2003, Merle invited me to speak and deliver in Jackson, Mississippi, the first honorary Medgar Evers Memorial Lecture. I met the governor of Mississippi. I was taken to the State House. Hundreds of people turned out to hear the lecture. As I prepared for that talk, I looked at the, as scholars always do, you access the bibliography, the previously published works on or about Medgar Evers, and I was shocked to discover that there was no one had ever put together in a single text the writings and speeches of Evers. There were more books about Brian Della Beckwith, the man who murdered Medgar Evers, than there were about Medgar Evers. When I went to Jackson, Mississippi, I learned that after Medgar was killed in 1963, that 16 file drawers, cabinet drawers of files, were discarded and thrown in the garbage by well-meaning NAACP workers who wanted to clear out the office for Charles Evers, Medgar's older brother, who assumed his role as the field secretary for the NAACP. Four file cabinet drawers were boxed and sent to the Evers family home where Medgar had been murdered. A well-meaning neighbor took all the boxes out to the garbage, and fortunately for history, three of those boxes were not taken by the garbage man. And it's those three boxes that I used to organize the autobiography of Medgar Evers. You see how fragile black history is?
Oh, yes, it is. And as a librarian, when I read this in the preface of the book, I was just sort of gripped like, oh, no. But you talk about the fact that the loss of these boxes doesn't just represent the loss of history, but that it has an impact on the present and the future.
In a very profound way, because Medgar Evers died in the effort to register to vote hundreds of thousands of black folk in Mississippi. And now, in the 21st century, once again, we're seeing the erosion of our civil rights and democratic right to vote in the United States. In the state of Mississippi today, 30% of all black males who have lost the right to vote for life because of a felony conviction. So that in states like Florida, where George W. Bush won the election, quote-unquote won, by 537 votes, 800,000 Floridians were denied the democratic right to vote because of these unjust criminal justice laws that disfranchise, that bar for life, people who have been previously convicted. So that people who've paid their debt to society already continue to pay the debt for the rest of their natural lives. That's not a democracy. Those kinds of discussions show how history lives on in the activities of the present and into the future. And living history, the theory that I present in the book, is that the boundaries between the past, the present, and the future are very, very narrow and very porous, and that a people, especially oppressed people, who don't know their own history, are incapable of making new history, because the parameters, the possibilities for the future, are set into motion by the foundation of the past.
You mentioned something else in here. You said that understanding how Medgar Evers employed tactics to energize and mobilize thousands of oppressed rural black folks to shake off their bondage and to boldly demand equal rights can provide practical examples of how a new generation of African Americans and other minorities might challenge racism today. And it hits me, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, and yet we do so often. And so just to be able to have access to this kind of information might save us some time, you know, save us the work of redoing what's already been done.
Exactly. Another example of this are the three missing chapters of the autobiography of Malcolm X. You know, this is a book that has acquired iconic status in the African-American imagination. It is the testament of a great black leader of the 20th century, Malcolm X. Yet, whenever I've picked it up and read it, I've always thought that something was not quite right. Something was missing. Malcolm was a consummate political actor, and yet in this autobiography, which was his final testament, there is no political program that lays out, after his break with the Nation of Islam, where he wanted to go, what directions, and how would he build a political strategy to empower African Americans. And my guess was right, because I learned over the course of writing the book that three chapters were deleted. Now, according to Alex Haley, who co-authored the autobiography, it was with the assent of Malcolm X after he returned from Mecca. We have to take Haley at his word. Nevertheless, when Haley died in 1991, there was an auction of his memorabilia. A Detroit attorney, Gregory Reed, purchased these three chapters that had been deleted from the original autobiography for the sum of $100,000. I flew to Detroit to negotiate with Reed to see the chapters. And I tell this hilarious story in Living Black History about how difficult it was for this attorney, who now has acquired this intellectual property and doesn't want anybody to see it, for me to glimpse at these missing chapters for 15 minutes. And all of that is described in the book.
It is. And in fact, these are just one or two examples, and you give some others of how our history ends up in locked boxes in the basements of academic and other institutions that the average person will never have access to.
That's right. That's the example of the great West Indian, the Caribbean scholar and activist C.L.R. James, where James, next to Du Bois, was arguably the most influential black intellectual of the 20th century, certainly the most important Caribbean intellectual. The author of The Black Jacobins, one of the greatest history books ever written, of the Haitian Revolution, published in 1938. Beyond a Boundary, his autobiographical text, which set into motion the entire field of cultural studies. Today, his papers, his archives, are locked in boxes in our library at Columbia University, Butler Library, because of the adjudication problem between two feuding factions within the James estate over who owns the property rights to the papers. Meanwhile, dozens of scholars who want to get at and have access to the James letters and correspondence and the unpublished manuscripts in this magnificent collection of James memorabilia are unable to proceed with their research because, once again, our material gets gentrified and removed from civic discussion and from accessibility.
Okay. I'm going to give the mic a rest for a moment and let my colleague O.B. Hill ask some questions.
Wow. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine.
Good. I was just amazed at the information in this book. It reads like a chronology of key history and historical points, not only for African Americans, but there's a lot of world history in here, too. Your methodology and your ability to have staff to do the type of research to put this type of work together is to be commended.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to know what you mean in terms of, or explain the concept of what is colorblind racism and what constitutes the constituent parts in today's society.
Well, as I say in Chapter 5, which is dedicated to a great American, Robert Carter, who was the architect for the Brown v. Board of Education lawsuit, which led to the dismantling of legal racial segregation in the United States in the Brown v. Board of Education decision of 1954. I start out that chapter discussing having lunch with Robert Carter and talking with him about his history. And the chapter really addresses the question of where are we a half century removed from the Brown decision. Segregation was always a curse, but it was a perverse blessing, in that if you were a PhD or a street sweeper, if you were both black, you rode at the back of the bus, that all of us had a sense of shared fate, that we were all struggling against this Leviathan, this monster of racial injustice that went by the name of Jim Crow, segregation. Now, a generation and two generations removed from the mid-20th century, we are now in the post-civil rights era of colorblind racism. You know, back 300 years ago, there was something called a triangle of racism, the triangle slave trade between Africa, America, and Europe. Well, today there's a new triangle, and that triangle of racism, of colorblind racism, where the signs have been removed, but the pattern of racial inequality remains, is the triangle between mass unemployment, mass incarceration, and mass disfranchisement. Mass unemployment. You've got communities like Harlem where half of the adult males, as I speak this morning, are either unemployed, underemployed, or in prison, or in jail, or in the military. So they are outside of the paid labor force. You've got, you know, mass unemployment leads to mass incarceration. A third of all prisoners were unemployed at the time of their arrest. Others averaged less than $20,000 annual income in the year prior to their arrest. And the 2,200,000 Americans who are in prison, half of whom are African American, is only the tip of the iceberg, because it's really about 5.5 or 6 million Americans who are at any given time in prison or jail on probation, parole, or awaiting trial. Then you have the problem of racialized inequality in the criminal justice system, that a black kid versus a white kid who commit the identical crime and face the same judge, the black child on a drug offense, a black child is 9 times more likely to be given time in a correctional adult facility than a white child, a white juvenile. And for the first offense, on a drug offense, the black youth is 48 times more likely statistically to be arraigned and placed in an adult correctional facility. And so then when you leave prison, in many states in this country, you lose the right to vote. In 12 states, it's for life. In Mississippi, in Florida, in a host of other states. In most American states, about 33 throughout the country, you lose the right to vote while you're in prison and when you're on parole. So I show how democracy and civil rights are being eroded through this deadly triangle, this triad of inequality that does not have the signs reading white and colored, but nevertheless, you see the pattern of history continuing to play itself out. Structural racism that was slavery, then Jim Crow segregation, then ghettoization, the use of residential patterns to preserve white superiority and black oppression. And now you have the colorblind racism of this new triad of mass unemployment, mass incarceration, mass disfranchisement. The first strategy in reversing this process of the new colorblind racism is first being aware of it and seeing that its roots are foundational to American history and that millions of white Americans live in denial of the existence of this new form of injustice. And the first step to actually engage in a civic conversation that's meaningful is to first identify what's wrong with the society and why it is that so many millions of our fellow citizens who happen to be white live in such denial. It's because they've constructed a story, a narrative about American history completely at odds with the facts, with the truth, that atrocities that have occurred in the past, everything from the African burial ground here in Manhattan to the destruction of an entire community of 2,500 African Americans, blacks in Tulsa, Oklahoma, completely obliterated in 1921. 200 black people murdered in that city, and the truth takes 60 years to come out. It's those kinds of silences and the obliteration of the truth of American history that informs the inability of white Americans to actually grapple with our shared suffering and the tragedies that form the foundation of the racial divide in the country.
Dr. Mirabal, we've received several calls wanting to know the title of the book again and your name and how they can get it. So the book is Living Black History, How Reimagining the African-American Past Can Remake America's Racial Future. It is written by Dr. Manning Mirabal, and it is published by Basic Civitas Books, a member of the Purchase Books Group. Okay, now we can go back to the interview.
We got five chapters here of some of the most dynamic analysis, including this triad that we talked about, that I've had a chance to put my hands on in a couple of decades. I'd like to for you to explain, in terms of what some of the solutions are, the term intellectual activists, and so our listeners will give them an understanding of what that is, and then give an example, if you may, of the role such an individual played during the civil rights movement.
All right. Well, I think that one of the things that Living Black History discusses is the importance of interrogating, going to sites of either racial atrocities or physical sites that are significant to the racialized history of the country, and engaging the public in a critical conversation about the significance of this site. So that if you go to Southern Virginia, you can find a number of the houses where you find literally bullet holes that are remnants of the Nat Turner slave uprising of August 1831. But there are no real sites where the state of Virginia has either honored or deplored this unsuccessful slave rebellion. This was the most famous slave rebellion in U.S. history. Yet for many years, for over two centuries, the only marker that denoted the site was a street sign that read Blackhead Signpost Road. This was back in the 19th century, where the severed head of a black slave who shared with Nat Turner a desire to be free and fought for his freedom, who was captured and they cut his head off, they put his head on a signpost. And the road, the name of that road, Blackhead Signpost Road, existed until just 3 years ago. So into the 21st century, that is the way white America demarks the suppression of the struggle for black freedom. Speaks volumes about what is missing from the story that white America tells about itself. And the historian can play a critical role. I describe in Living Black History the efforts that I engaged in, along with some colleagues at Columbia University, to create a permanent memorial for Malcolm X at the site of his assassination, the Audubon Ballroom. We built a web-based multimedia series of kiosks, educational programming, so that last year, on the 40th anniversary of, on the 80th anniversary of Malcolm's birth, the Shabazz family and I were, and Columbia University were able to celebrate with the opening of the site with a full-sized representation, a statue of Brother Malcolm X, and a huge, gorgeous mural at the site of his assassination. So there are ways that you can use history in creative ways to help promote racial reconciliation, but reconciliation that's grounded in the truth of history, not in its suppression and not in lies about the past. You know, I live in Manhattan, and, you know, Wall Street, African Americans built the first wall on Wall Street. You know, we were the first stock on the stock exchange, because the stock exchange was a slave stock, where at the base of the East River, tens of thousands of slaves poured into Manhattan over a period of 150 years. New York City was the second, after Charleston, South Carolina, was the second most profitable port for slavery in British North America for 150 years. And yet, until very recently, all of this was deeply denied by the history books, no mention of it in the textbooks of the children. But now there's a whole movement to change that. The states of New Jersey, New York, and now, several days ago, Illinois, have passed laws requiring the incorporation of African American history, that it be taught in all social science courses, in junior high and senior high throughout those three states.
Well,
and it's called the Amstead Commission. That's right.
Let me say this. You just explained the role of the intellectual activist. Do you see yourself as one? Now,
always have. I always have. In the tradition of W.E.B. Du Bois.
You're listening to KBOO Black Book Talk.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left, and in that I wanted to, we want to reserve a little bit of time at the end to talk about Black History Month events here in Portland, but you had mentioned that one of the pivotal events in your life was attending Dr. Martin Luther King's funeral, and now as the nation is mourning the death of his wife, Mrs. Coretta Scott King, I was hoping if you could tell us just in the next minute or so what that meant to you, why being at that funeral was so important to you.
It was a crucial event in my own development as a young African American and as an American. I covered the funeral for the black newspaper in Dayton, Ohio, where I was from, and the first time I ever traveled on an airplane in my life, I was 17 years old, and I arrived at Ebenezer Baptist Church at 6:30 a.m. I was the first person there, I believe. And I covered the entire funeral, walked along with Martin and the mule team and the wagon that took his body to Atlanta University, and I heard the eloquent and moving eulogy by Dr. Benjamin Mays, his mentor, at Morehouse College. And I saw that an individual through sacrifice and struggle can transform and change the future. That's what Dr. King did. That's what Coretta did by fighting courageously to honor her husband with a national holiday. Without her personal leadership and sacrifice, that never would have occurred.
You know, I don't think that it overstates it to say that in this book and the other books that you've written and all the other things that you've done, you are a multimedia person, that you too have absolutely shaped, carved, influenced the history of African-American people in this country. I hope that you will come to Portland soon. We have to close now, but this is a conversation that needs
to continue. I love Portland. Well, I would love to come out there.
And you have to come on back, and you have to be in the studio. We thank you very much for joining us. And again, we urge all of our listeners to get Living Black History, How Reimagining the African-American Past Can Remake America's Racial Future by Manning Marable. And now we want to just mention that, you know, because this is African-American History Month here in Portland, there are going to be tons of things to do. Go to all of the college websites because colleges are doing great things. Next week, Michael Eric Dyson will be at Reed College. That's Friday, February 17th. Tomorrow evening, the Black Student Union at Lewis and Clark College is sponsoring a night of slam poetry with Rochelle Rodizi Hart, Xavier Eli Burton. This is tomorrow, February 8th. 7 p.m. in the co-op. Let's see. Also at Lewis and Clark, the Black Like Me exhibit is continuing, started in January, continues. And, of course, I would be remiss if I did not say that this Sunday at the North Portland Branch Library, Multnomah County Library, we'll be celebrating the African American Read-In, 2:30 to 4:30. Come out and hear. Steve... lost my notes. Okay, come out and hear Commissioner Sam Adams, KGW Weatherman, Dave Selesky, Past and Art founder Jerry Foster, and a lovely, lovely senior couple, Mr. and Mrs. Nathan and Lois Jackson, reading from the works of their favorite African-American authors. And then on Saturday, February 25th, from 3:30 to 5:30, come out and learn about genealogy. Come to Roots. Jumpstart your African-American genealogy. And one of our speakers will be O.B. Hill. Again, good February to you. Thank you all for joining us. We will see you next month in March. Good reading to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Community College would like to invite you to the 16th Annual African Film Festival honoring Black History Month at PCC's Cascade Campus. This year's festival will feature 28 political, historical, and socially charged films as seen through the eyes of Africans. The films will cover a wide range of themes and topics, from the African legacy in Mexico, women's ongoing struggle for equality and independence, to love across class lines and preservation of African cultural and artistic heritage. This KBOO co-sponsored festival will be free of charge and will cover a five-week period from February 3rd through March 4th. For more information, go to www.africanfilmfestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned at 10:30 for Stage and Studio. Topics include Tears of Joy Theater's The Monkey King and Damali Ayo's Paint Mixers. And now, Kathleen Stevenson's guest is Reverend Dr. Barbara Rossing, author of The Rapture Exposed, The Message of Hope in the Book of Revelation.